Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. You'll find out in a minute why we're playing My Country, Tis of Thee. But remember, we will have live coverage on the show today of President Obama's announcement of changes to the NSA surveillance programs revealed by Edward Snowden. The announcement is scheduled for 11 o'clock. We'll hear what the president is proposing as a new balance between privacy and security. And considering who is most likely to have their constitutional rights abused by excessive surveillance these days, one person very interested to hear the president's proposals is undoubtedly my next guest, America's only Muslim congressman, Democrat Keith Ellison of Minnesota. He happens to be in New York today on a book tour. He was coming on our show anyway today, so we will get his pre-action to the president and talk about other things. His book is called My Country, Tis of Thee, My Faith, My Family, Our Future. Congressman Ellison, thanks so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Hey, thanks for having me. So honored to be on with you.
And you're right that it never occurred to you when you ran for Congress in 2006 that you would be making history. Did you not realize there were no other Muslim members of Congress?
You know, I didn't know until I stepped before a group of microphones after I'd won the Democratic Farmer Labor endorsement and was asked by a reporter, "Well, if you win, are you Muslim? And if you win, will you be the first?" And I actually had to say, I don't know, and I hadn't even thought about it.
How did you feel about being asked your religion?
You know, I was put off by it. I was a little surprised by it. I didn't know how it was relevant. I had spent two terms in the Minnesota state legislature, and in that time, I had invited my imam, who is a prayer leader in Islamic faith, to do an opening prayer for the legislative session, as is done every day by Christian and Jewish and other ministers. And my colleagues knew that I was a Muslim, and everybody was really comfortable with it. So when it became sort of a political issue when I was running for federal office, it did take me by surprise. But then somebody said to me, they said, you know, Keith, imagine somebody of Japanese ancestry being elected to Congress a few years after Pearl Harbor. It might mean something about the country's tolerance. It might mean something about the country's commitment to inclusion and diversity and treating people as individuals, not just members of a group.
And maybe we
I think that's how I see it. Huh?
And maybe we should say you're not of Middle Eastern descent or from Afghanistan or Indonesia or anywhere. You're African American. So
that's
do you
right.
come from the Black Muslim tradition?
Well, I come from the tradition of world Islam as taught by Prophet Muhammad 1,400 years ago. I follow the Quran, the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad called the Hadith and the traditional Sunni Islam.
You don't want to make any distinctions there between Black Muslim or Middle Eastern Muslim or...
No, I don't come out of the Nation of Islam tradition. I've worked with them and I know people in that group, but no, I took what they call Shahada, which just means witness, in Detroit in a very traditional Muslim mosque, which was populated by African Americans. It's called the Muslim Center. It's over there on Rosa Parks and Davidson, for anybody who knows that area in Detroit.
And you converted, right? At 20, you weren't raised Muslim.
That's right. I was converted to Islam at the age of 19, and my children have all been born in the faith and raised in it, but nope, I'm a convert.
If people listen to a lot of conservative talk radio, the one thing they probably have heard about you is that you were an organizer of Louis Farrakhan's Million Man March in Washington in 1995. True, right?
Well, yeah, it is true, but I wouldn't call it Louis Farrakhan's Million Man March. I would call it the Million Man March. It's true that he called it, and he was a major speaker at it, but it was much bigger than any individual. In fact, there were people of a wide range of experiences who were there, Christians, people all over the nation, many ages, people of different levels of education and profession, very, very few who were specific members of his organization. But the point is that, you know, African-Americans were in a certain state of transition in 1995. I mean, we had emerged from Jim Crow segregation into the civil rights period, and then civil rights laws had been enacted for 20 years by that time, and yet disparities were abounding in health, education, and employment, and in housing, and in various ways of life. And the question was asked, you know, what's the next thing? Because we've defeated Jim Crow segregation, and yet, you know, we still have too much community violence, not enough educational attainment, and people are still going through some significant challenges. And so that was the real question, you know, what's next, right? So when the march was called, it really didn't matter who called it. What mattered was that it was called, and it resonated with wide range of people. And from it, you know, we got a lot of people registered to vote. We did a lot of good work to do something about black kids in foster care and out-of-home placement. There's a lot of things that came out of that effort that were very, very meritorious. In fact, the thing that it showed me is that it reinforced my belief that there's tremendous hope and promise in the American dream, and that if we come together and address our issues and seek redress from our government, that, you know, the future is really bright. And I believe that the Million Man March was one of the foundational blocks that led to the election of President Obama, one of the many, but certainly one of them.
Because it inspired you and many other people to careers in public service or to other kinds of activism. And I remember the Million Man March. That was one of its primary stated goals, to help get a new generation of community activists going.
That's right. And it certainly did that. And it certainly did that. I know that when I got home, you know, I was inspired. I was elated, and I, in my mind, was not on separation. It was on how we can really make this promise of America the promise that everyone shares, not how to exclude, right? It was the idea that, look, if a million men or more can assemble at the mall of this country, right in front of the Capitol, and say, hey, you know what? We are the great-great-grandsons of the slaves, and we're still here to try to collect on this promise of liberty and justice for all. And what are we going to do about it? Part of it's our job. Part of it's the government's job to make a fair and level playing field. And that idea, I walked out of there thinking, man, you know, great things await us. You know, if we would just get organized, get involved, and use the rights that we're promised.
My guest is Congressman Keith Ellison, Democrat from Minnesota, chairman of the Progressive Caucus in the House, the only Muslim in Congress, and the author now of My Country, Tis of Thee, My Faith, My Family, Our Future. One second, let me just put out the phone number and invite people to call in and ask you a couple of questions. 212-433-WNYC. If you have a question for Congressman Ellison today, 212-433-9692. What'd you want to say?
Oh, I just want to say there, Andre Carson is Muslim. He represents the district in Indianapolis, Indiana.
Ah,
and so there's two of us.
So you were the first, but you're not currently the only.
But I wasn't the last. And a lot of the tricks they pulled on me, they tried to pull on him too, but they didn't work, proving that Americans really don't care for appeals to religious diversion and religious distraction and religious division.
Is it possible that the two of you are the only open Muslims in Congress and there's any more that are in the closet?
Who knows? You know, it's possible. I could tell you this. There's a lot of young Muslims who are in public service across this country who I believe could also serve. Their primary goal is to serve the public, not carry a religious banner. But, you know, you got a young woman in Michigan called Rashida Tlaib. She's awesome. You got others across the country who are all trying to get involved because they love this country and they want to serve it. And it's something that is really catching on. Activism, involvement, making our country better, making a contribution.
Why'd you name your book My Country, Tis of Thee?
You know, because I'll never forget the moment when I was standing watching Barack Obama be sworn in as the 44th president. I'd already spent 2 years in Congress, and it was freezing cold January day, and I heard Aretha Franklin belt out this amazing rendition of My Country, Tis of Thee. And as I reflected on the words, it occurred to me that at the other end of the mall, you know, Martin Luther King had used those same words in his famous I Have a Dream speech. And, you know, how ironic it would be, you know, it was that at that moment, these people, you know, descendants of people of African descent, some of whom have a slave heritage like myself and Aretha Franklin, you know, we're singing this great song, this anthem of liberty, and it was sort of a promise being fulfilled that we had overcome something. And, you know, it's common nowadays to hear people talk about how much more work we have to do to overcome racial separation and subordination. But can we take 10 seconds to just talk about the long road we have in fact traveled? I mean, it's not in any way saying that we're not going to keep fighting if we just take a moment to say, this country used to hold people in slavery. They used to literally sell slaves on the mall. Slaves built the Capitol, and yet here's somebody of African descent being sworn in as the president. This is a tremendous achievement by America, not just black Americans, but all of Americans. We are making amazing progress toward what King would call the beloved community. And I think that is something to feel really good about. Now, we're not saying we're not going to deal with the achievement gap. We're not going to stop fighting to close the employment gap. All these are things we're still going to keep work on. But can we just take a moment to say, wow, you know, this country that promised liberty but denied it to Africans is now making good on some promises that it made a long time ago. I think that's a beautiful thing.
Shouting out the progress, Congressman.
Yeah, man, why not?
Keith Ellison. Also, with respect to the title and the song, you refer to an abolitionist version of Country Tis of Thee, because there are some additional lyrics to the ones that people usually know, added later for the abolitionist movement in the 1800s. And I thought that our listeners might like to hear a little bit of that, because they probably, most of them, have never heard this. So here is a little bit of the Dutchess Anti-Slavery Singers under the auspices of the Mid-Hudson Anti-Slavery History Project in the Mid-Hudson Valley right here in New York, Dutchess County, singing in March of this year. Listen.
My country tis of thee, stronghold of slavery, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, where men man's rights deride, from every mountainside thy deed shall
pretty pointed stuff, Congressman.
Yeah, man. Yeah, I mean, but it's there, right? And at the moment that song was written, it was true. And yet, it's not all that defines us, right? It doesn't have to be who we are. We can have an aspiration, you know, beyond the reality of slavery, Jim Crow, racism, and segregation. We can aspire to be in a society where people are included without regard to the superficialities of skin color, sexual orientation, religion, and gender. We can aspire to be that beloved community, and I think we should try. And it may take 100 more years, but why not go for it? Why not try to, you know, make this country all that it could be? So that's kind of why I wrote the book. I wanted people to understand that we have to be optimistic. The pessimists are not realistic. They're often wrong. The pessimists say, oh, you can't stop slavery, man. It's been around for 240 years. It'll never end. Well, it ended. You can't stop Jim Crow. Well, it ended. You can't stop women. You can't get women to vote because it's never going to end. Men are always going to stop that. Well, they have it. And so my point is that, you know, it's just as realistic to be optimistic as to be pessimistic. Good things happen, but you got to make them happen.
Minnesotans are so upbeat. Ibrahim in Queens, you're on WNYC with Congressman Keith Ellison. Hello.
Hi, good morning, Brian. Good morning, Congressman. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, Ibrahim. Juma mubarak.
Congressman Keith, my question is it ignorance or is it bias when people hold other people accountable based solely on their religion, not on their individual deeds or character? The reason why I'm bringing this, because I remember during, if you go back to history, during the enslavement of our people, you had these so-called white masters having enslaved Africans in the dungeons, and on Sundays these guys are upstairs praising the Lord, reading the Bible.
Yeah. Well, you know what, Ibrahim, I think it's both, really, because, you know, if you go back to slavery days, and this is shown in the movie 12 Years a Slave, they have really mean-hearted, evil masters, and many of them are just informed by ignorance, and they believe blacks are less than them. And then they had a master who was a so-called good master, I put that in quotes, because he wouldn't let go of his slaves because it just made him money. So it was just power. It wasn't even ignorance. It was just, this institution serves me and puts money in my pocket, so I'm going to keep it going. And others were just ignorant and just didn't know. But the truth is, it's probably a mixture of both. It's probably power and the lust for power and wealth and greed and ignorance. And they both kind of help each other out, right? Sometimes, Ibrahim, there's willful ignorance, right? Like if you don't want to do anything about a biased stop and search policy or stop and frisk policy, you don't want to do anything about it because you like the outcome of it, you know, which gives some people privileges and denies them to others, then you may act like you don't know. But the truth is, it doesn't move our society toward liberty and justice for all. So thanks for the question.
And Ibrahim, thanks for your call. Our time is fleeing so quickly, and since we do have President Obama's speech coming up at 11 o'clock announcing some kinds of changes, we'll find out what, to the NSA surveillance programs revealed by Edward Snowden. As chairman of the House Progressive Caucus, are you one of those progressives disappointed with what some call the Bushification of Obama's national security policies?
Well, we've had some serious concerns. You know, we really have, and we've raised questions with the president about everything from NSA spying to the use of drones to a number of things. You know, but again, you know, it goes back to the book for me. In the book, the central message is, if we are active and if we are optimistic, we can make a better change. And because Americans all over this country were outraged at what they found out about the metadata collection, about the lack of any showing of probable cause before searching these databases, the fishing expeditions, people raised issues. And the president responded. I think that the lesson is, no matter how progressive you think a president or any leader, including me, may be, it is your duty as an active citizen to raise the issues. And you should never stop that, even if you think that leader's on your side. You should always be an activist, always be agitating for justice and inclusion.
What are you hoping to hear from the president today on surveillance, and have you been told anything that he will say?
Well, I haven't had any specialized briefings, but I can tell you that I'm, one, glad that he responded. Two, I like the idea of the government not collecting all this metadata. I'd like to know what exactly does he mean by leaving the metadata in private hands. And by metadata, what I mean is all of the information that they've been collecting on nearly everybody. I don't think the government should be collecting that, and I think it should stay in private hands. I also think there needs to be some showing to a judicial officer why the database needs to be queried. And I think it's a good idea to have a privacy advocate who can challenge any law enforcement or counterterrorist body before they make a case to query the data. But I will tell you this: I still want to know what considerations do they have before they decide to issue a warrant?
They don't say very much at the FISA court.
Yeah, you know, like what's going on? So I think that it's a good development. Where will it lead us? Good question. I'm glad that the president has taken it seriously, but I'm going to tell you this. I think even the best of all possible worlds, you got to have active citizens. And so we're going to hash this thing out, debate it. And so, but I am looking forward to seeing a privacy advocate looking out for the public interest.
And we will hear if that's one of the things that President Obama actually proposes in that speech that is scheduled for 10 minutes from now. We will carry it. I want to thank Minnesota Congressman Keith Ellison, his new book, My Country, Tis of Thee, My Faith, My Family, Our Future. I really appreciate it. I hope we can talk again.
Oh, yeah, I'll be looking forward to it.